Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this one-hour broadcast is World Watchers. It is program number 815 and July the 20th, 1987. I have to make apologies for a hoarse throat. I've been using my voice a lot. In addition to World Watchers, I've done a lot of interviews of various radio programs around the country this past week, and I think I have used my voice too much. Many of you don't know, and I do have an unusual voice, I suppose, a little raspiness in there. I have had two operations on my vocal cords. They were a long time ago, and the voice works pretty good, but I should not use it for so many broadcasts. And this week I'm not going to do any, and I'm going to cut down on those. Incidentally, I was reading an article on Ronald Reagan's decision to invade Grenada was partly influenced by Claudia Colbert, who has property on the island of Barbados, and she was worried about communist Maurice Bishop and the islands nearby. And Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan frequented, went down to her place one or two times. They've been long, long friends from Hollywood, and one of the papers, Parade Magazine, or one of them said that she was the one who kind of coaxed Reagan to overtake Grenada and get rid of the communists. It was Claudette Colbert's husband, Dr. Joel Pressman, who did the two surgeries on my throat. The last one was 32 years ago, and everything's been pretty good since then. But no, I take it back. There was one 10 years later. But I have to give those vocal cords a rest, cut down the telephone time. So if it sounds a little raspy here, it is. But the fact that I could use my voice as long as I did and hope to use it in the future was Dr. Joel Pressman, the late husband of Claudette Colbert. He passed away a few years ago. There's a long article in one of the newspapers, and they're repeating it on the radio every 5 minutes, I suppose, on the cost of keeping the hearings going, the Iran-Contra hearings, and the special prosecutor that may come to $6 million. I would like the listeners of World Watchers to participate and help me by writing to members of Congress, people with the last name of A to L, perhaps write to the House of Representatives, those with the last name of M to Z, write to the Senate and ask an estimate cost of keeping our ships in the Persian Gulf at a time where members of Congress don't approve, our allies don't approve, and not, forget it, if we have a shooting war, the cost couldn't be estimated. But what does it cost to flag the Kuwait ships and keep our battleships and planes flying over them to allow Kuwait to deliver the oil to Iraq and around the world? Now, I mentioned several times, and most of you saw the news accounts of that secret plot that William Casey at the CIA, the Defense Department, were brewing for a long time to have a self-financed, super-secret intelligence operation that I compared to the Super Seize Me in Italy that Michael Ledeen and Alexander Haig were a part of, a government outside of a government outside of the National Security Council. The NSA director doesn't have to be approved by the Senate or any member of Congress. The National Security Council and the National Security Agency have no freedom of information where you get access or facts about their past. So outside of their agencies is still a more secret little door, and we've talked about this, and I will continue to bring up this topic as frequently as it is necessary. But I just want to cite a change in perception around the world, and particularly in one newspaper out in San Francisco, the San Francisco Examiner. This paper was founded and owned by the Hearst family, very conservative. They were very pro-Hitler. They had many articles by Goering and Goebbels. And now they carry the news this way that sounds like Mae Brussel. Big headlines across the front of the page. Government within a government. North drops a bombshell about Casey's secret plan. Well, Casey came from the OSS and the Office of Strategic Services, and then went into the CIA when it was formed, and has been part of the inner team since World War II. It's interesting, though, to see these headlines on a paper like The Examiner. My first published article in The Realist in 1972 described two governments side by side, a federal emergency management system, and James McCord was part of a 16-member team of that group that was originally set up by Ronald Reagan and Edwin Meese and the Defense Department, with the nucleus for fermenting the original problems from rounding people up coming out of here from California in the mines of Reagan and his associates. It's interesting now, though, to see the San Francisco Examiner with a headline that covers the basis of the material that I've been trying to explain on the air for 16 years. A few weeks later, just this last Sunday, the 19th San Francisco Examiner has an editorial. William Randolph Hearst III is the editor and publisher. The buck stops where? And, pardon me, the article, the editorial says, here was a long-awaited moment of accountability. Who authorized the diversion of arms sales and the profits to Iran to go to Nicaragua? The buck stops with me, said Rear Admiral John Poindexter. And who indeed was John Poindexter to be letting the buck stop with him? Harry Truman made the assertion because he was president, and when the policy decision is of this magnitude, it should go to the president. We're talking about a decision to collide with the will of Congress on a matter of armed conflict abroad and set up a secret apparatus to which funds would flow. So secret that even the president didn't know any of the particulars, the admiral said. He did that so the Oval Office persons could have deniability. Well, the editorial says, it is a thin and odious web that Poindexter wove, and Poindexter is an admiral who graduated number one in his class in Annapolis out of 900 students. While it gives Reagan technical legal protection, it does not remove him from final responsibility. Everything with tar on it was too neatly and consciously avoided by the president and his top administrators, and when the lid finally was blown on the arms sales fiasco, Poindexter resigned as head of the NSC. Nobody at the top asked him as he departed the White House whether he approved the diversion of the arms sales to the Contras, which later he said he did, but he didn't tell the president. Nobody there wanted the information because it was politically and legally radioactive. I should go back and say he only admitted that he approved of the diversion when one memo was found. He was assured by Ollie North that they were all destroyed, so he could say, you know, this deniability. But one was found, then he had to take the responsibility. Poindexter was allowed to leave carrying it off as if he didn't know what happened, and obviously he was confident beforehand that he was carrying out the larger intent of the president on a no-questions-asked basis. Reagan had made the point with the Congress that he wanted to fund the Contras. The details of getting the legislative ban he just left to others, foremost of those being an admiral and a lieutenant colonel. Two members from the Defense Department, two still wearing their uniforms, and they were the ones responsible, the Pentagon were. And if you heard the testimony of Poindexter, he said that Oliver North never spoke at a meeting where the president was unless he gave him a nod, and nothing went to the president that didn't pass in front of his desk. So that the admiral from the Pentagon literally runs the NSC, and then the question is, what role does Fritz Kramer on the NSC, who was plans officer of the Pentagon through the entire Vietnam War over General Westmoreland and Abrams, sitting there, does he have the control over the admiral, being the elder statesman who had such a big job in the Pentagon and who shares offices with Daniel Graham, former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency? Now the editorial of the San Francisco Examiner, of all places, says, this hole-wrenching process has illuminated the serious question of how the constitutional balance of power can be made to work. It is time to evaluate the role Congress should properly play. The hearings have ironically showed that Congress was not only an imperfect instrument in foreign affairs, but Reagan had learned to get the better of it. For it is not Reagan's interest is not at stake, not just Reagan, but the future of American policy on the world scale. And what I have said continuously on the air with World Watchers or wherever I was speaking or writing, the problem isn't the CIA, it is the National Security Council. It is the National Security Agency with the executive branch that tilted the Constitution, and the future of American policy all over the world is in danger if the admirals and generals make all decisions and move towards these fascist governments that they've put into power. They've made them possible, and now they're their allies. Carl Bernstein wrote an article for the Washington Post July 14th, and pardon me, it was reprinted in the New York Times, TV anchor men are missing the big story, the hearings. And he blasts out about the point of Tom Brokaw and some of these various persons being in the news media, missing and covering up what these hearings are about. Now, he has the same fault. He covered up the whole point of Watergate, the planned coup in 1972, the Lewis Tackwood allegations, Squad 19, the Federal Emergency Management Group, where Reagan at that time period was still governor, working with Edwin Meese, the plans for the San Diego Convention in Reagan's home state. Carl Bernstein wouldn't touch any of that. And they missed the point of Watergate, what was planned for the convention in Miami after it moved from San Diego but was stopped because the men arrested at the Watergate Hotel had money and banking accounts that would link to people who had already been given guns and agents provocateurs in the Miami area to create a situation to cancel our constitutional rights and to kidnap and round up the radicals. It's easy for Carl Bernstein to write that persons in the hearings are giving one message and the news media comes up front and misinterprets it or misses the point. But I believe we are where we are today because people like Carl Bernstein wouldn't get the point of Watergate, even though they were informed and missed the point then. And when you cover up that, it is, again, one more piece of scandal that is allowed to putrefy and rot and then reappears in another stinking form and reemerges. People involved with the Watergate, like William Casey and Mr. Buchanan, was writing a very important article today, syndicated column under Enterprise Incorporated. I wonder if it was paid for by C-Corp. But the important thing is that by covering up Watergate and then going back covering up the Kennedy assassination, I don't know where Carl Bernstein was at that time, but the whole news media missed the point on the Warren Report, the Kennedy assassination, and they missed it at Watergate, and now he's accusing them, the anchorman, of missing the point now, and he can join the crowd for being part of the cover-up, and nobody can be clean, and a lot of people can point fingers at each other, and it isn't going to solve our problems. Now, 1974, July the 11th, Jack Anderson wrote an article, and as he's told you many times in interviews and on TV, he's in and out of the Defense Department in the White House. This is what he wrote. Preparing for the big one. This is 1984, 3 years ago. Secret Pentagon planning documents raise the specter of a confrontation in the Persian Gulf between the United States and the Soviet Union. This is sort of the flashpoint that could ignite the nuclear power keg, the big one being World War III. Most scenarios circulating inside the Pentagon forecast an Iranian victory, a possible Iranian victory, followed by the spread of Ayatollah Khomeini's Muslim fundamentalism in Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Persian Gulf states. As settling as this would be, it probably wouldn't provide a Soviet-American conflict. This is the script they had several years ago. Let's watch it. This week we start flagging the Kuwait ships. It wouldn't be enough to make war with Russia if Iran won the war against Iraq and spread themselves south into the other countries in the Persian Gulf. But the opposite outcome, a desperate escalation of the war by Iraq with the destruction of Iran's oil export facilities, with the collapse of the Iranian economy, would bring the Soviets. What they planned in the Pentagon is if the Iraqis get strong and the United States is going to tilt Iraq now with Kuwait to help them against the war in Iran. If Iraq is strong and destroys Iran's oil export facilities, and we're talking about first strikes against Iran, then the Soviets would come down to protect Iran, and then the United States would fight the Soviets. One of the secret Pentagon documents examined by my associate, Donald Goldberg, emphasizes that the scenario is merely a hypothetical war that portrays enemy capabilities as indicated by intelligence estimates. Now, after Salvador Allende was murdered in Chile and Augusto Pinochet was put in by the Defense Department, the CIA, ITT, and other corporations, it turned out that they had scenarios and scripts and hypothetical wars. They were studied up at the universities in New England, and those hypothetical war contingencies were used for the overthrow of Allende, destabilization of the economy, breaking up the unions and strikes and so forth, building up to a 10-part plan for taking over Chile. Now, Jack Anderson says, here is the secret scenario, which begins 65 days before open combat between the United States and the Soviet Union. And I suggest maybe you make copies of this tape to send to members of Congress that you think might be interested. They may not remember this article. Minus 65, the Iranian economy is in ruins. The volatile Iranian people rise up against Khomeini and his mullahs, causing dissolution of the central authority in Iran. That's minus 65 to World War III, keeping in mind Ronald Reagan's Armageddon philosophy and also what Oliver North was doing, according to documents that have been released and news articles not brought up in front of the Iran-Contra hearings, was to send arms to people like Mr. Gorbanifar, who was part of the Savak, to get weapons in the hands of Iran, to have an uprising and to kill Khomeini, which would create a response, a confrontation between the various elements. And the script here was that before we would fight Russia, there would be this confrontation of the Iranian people against Khomeini, against each other, to dissolution of the central authority. Minus 62, 3 days later, the Soviet forces in Transcaucasus, north of the Caucasus and Turkestan, begin selective mobilization because they believe that America is going to come in into the Iranian Sea. The United States responds by moving its forward deployed carrier and amphibious force into a better position, which is what we're getting ready to do now. Minus 37, the Kremlin reaffirms its 1921 friendship treaty with Iran and continues the preparation for the invasion. The United States deploys additional AWACS planes and naval forces. Remember that Oliver North and General Secord participated in a plan, and North got a medal for it, whereby he got Congress to send the AWACS to Saudi Arabia, many AWACS, and we promised AWACS to Jordan, and we are delivering these as fast as we can. Minus 23 days till World War III, or confrontation of U.S. with Soviets. United States intelligence reports up to 10 Soviet divisions are conducting training operations on the Iranian border, which we've heard in this recent testimony. We don't know if it's true or not true, but those dealings with Iranians are the basis that the Russians are on the border, this many are there, and this was written up in 1984. They're conducting training operations. President Reagan will call up 1,000 reserve troops and put U.S. forces around the world on a low-level alert. Supplies begin moving toward the Persian Gulf. And just read your papers for the last month and see how the supplies are moving. Minus 16, the Soviet Union announces that it is prepared to unilaterally invoke the 1921 treaty, which permits the Soviet troops to move into Iran. The United States intelligence detects a major increase of traffic on the Soviet railroads in the provinces bordering Iran. Minus 12, the U.S. intelligence determines that a Soviet invasion of Iran is imminent, and partial mobilization begins in the United States. On D-Day, the Soviet air attacks throughout Iran paved the way for a massive invasion of 24 Russian divisions to protect the Iranians against the United States moving into there. The United States Air Force and Soviets engage in combat over the skies of Iran. U.S. intelligence detects heightened Cuban readiness, and the United States warns Cuba. Plus 2 more days, the United States determines that the Warsaw Pact preparations have reached a level that indicate an attack is likely on Western Europe. Washington calls formal NATO mobilization. Plus 6 more days, NATO mobilizes, and the U.S. rushes in their full-scale reinforcements. The Soviet bloc forces smash into Western Europe, and at least 90 divisions, and on the other side of the globe, North Korea could attack South Korea. Now, with that in mind, I'm going into the subject of Iran. I was going to also briefly mention, before I get into continuation of Iran, that Newsweek has an article blaming Oliver North for leaks and disinformation. And this is very important because the excuse for the persons in the National Security Agency and National Security Council never telling Congress the truth, and in fact lying to them, is that they leak. And the truth is that leaks come out from Oliver North, and leaks came out from North about the Berlin Disco that caused he and Poindexter to bomb Libya, and leaks came out from them about other incidents involving the Achille Lauro and the TW Air flight, and so that those leaks from those people that are absolute lies that they're blaming on members of Congress could instigate a World War III because they have the mouthpiece that they're blaming on Congress, and thank goodness Newsweek, which is not, again, a very liberal, some people think it is, I think it's more like the Randolph Hearst newspapers, is concerned with the lies that we are being told. The Wall Street Journal had a story today: Congress and the press continue the tug of war over the constitutional authority on foreign policy. That, again, will continue on and on until the National Security Council is recognized for being the agency that tilted the balance of our Constitution as it was written. These members of Congress keep signing the Constitution. There is the legislative, the members of Congress, there is the executive, which is the president, and there is the judiciary, which is the Justice Department and Supreme Court. But when the National Security Council was made in 1947, as soon as Reinhard Gehlen came to this country and Hitler's top advisors were brought to this country, along with British intelligence and William Stevenson, they created an office that lopsides the executive branch, and they pound into his ear what he's to know. They pound into his ear how many troops are on the Russian border. They tell him how many tanks are here and there. Then if Congress doesn't believe them or questions them, then they go ahead and act on what the president is told, because the president would respond the way they want, being given the facts he was told. And they can give lies, they can give leaks, they can give propaganda, and what they're doing doesn't work. And the fact that it doesn't work is proved in many, many books and articles that are coming out. William Pfaff, a writer from Paris who I quote many times, has an article this week, "The United States is a War Behind." And he said it's not only the generals who are a war behind, the officials, the politicians, the policymakers, and this goes into the 40 Committee, the National Security Council, they are way behind. People commonly are shaped by decisive historical events in their youth. We think of the Western powers who resisted Hitler at Munich, who failed to resist him at Munich, and the American policymakers later, the generation said that we should continue now and not give in to totalitarianism because we were weak in recognizing Hitler at Munich. And William Pfaff, who lives in Paris, said, "We have misidentified as Hitlerian threats all through the 1950s and all through the 1960s what were not Hitlerian effects on our culture. Those were the last war." He says the veteran officer of the CIA, William Casey, came out of the OSS. The CIA was not the OSS. The Office of Strategic Services fought when a moral and political choice was plain. When choices were plain, Americans had no doubt about their cause during the time of Mussolini, Hitler, and Franco. And when the people who collaborated with the OSS happened to be the best of their generation, writers and thinkers and so forth, he said virtually every time the CIA tried to act as the OSS, and the CIA was formed in 1947 by Reinhard Gehlen and Hitler's top people, when the CIA tries to act as the OSS, it finds itself making unsustainable promises and eventually betraying those who they gave their trust. The American administration in power would discover its secret wars are going nowhere. They're ceasing to be secret. They're provoking political unease or opposition at home. And the coming liabilities with respect to other policies being pressed would call them off. He says, and I cite the Iranian case where we overthrew Mossadegh and put in the Shah, killed Mossadegh, Guatemala where our Benz was killed, Dominican Republic with Trujillo killed, in Dallas where our own president was killed, in Vietnam when Diem was killed, in Pakistan where Bhutto was killed, in Chile when Allende was killed, in South Korea when the president was killed, in Peru when the president was killed. We had coups in, we removed the president in Bolivia, and we've had these endless coups where people were forced out of office, and I've cited just a few that have been murdered. That doesn't cover Lumumba in the Congo and all, when they begin to get their independence. You could go on, and I do many times. But these things are all failure. And Mr. Pfaff says the agency found that those who would collaborate in its enterprises were not so often so selfless patriots of the war years. Some were heroes. More than were heroes were mercenaries. We have trained mercenaries that are sent out by Robert Brown and General Singlaub. They're marginals. The best collaborators of William Casey and Colonel North, the only ones they could find for their Iranian operation, were an officer who had retired under an ethical cloud, an Iranian business partner who declared he was in it for the money, an Iranian fixer with whom the CIA considered a liar, that was Mr. Ghorbanifar, and a Saudi Arabian commission man, that's Adnan Khashoggi. Mr. Pfaff says the CIA officer I quoted above says of the Contras, the officer said, they are our equivalent for Central America of Franklin Roosevelt's WPA. The Contras give hungry peasants' kids a chance to make money. The peasant kids, they are risk, but what do those kids know about what they're getting into? The American public will not go to war to put the Contras in power, and they will prove unable to seize power alone. A lot of bloodletting will end in nothing. Casey's project for a privately owned, off-the-shelf, self-sustaining, standalone Secret Service and his willingness to go along with Iranian arms sales, even though Iran wasn't freeing the hostages, so as raised money to pay for the enterprise, which seems to be what was happening, amounted to an effort to recreate an OSS to do what he could not make the CIA do. Yet the reason the CIA disappointed him is that this is 1987 and is not 1942. Mikhail Gorbachev is not Adolf Hitler, Daniel Ortega is not Adolf Hitler, and Nicaragua is not Vietnam. Now that comes out of Paris and pretty well summarizes in the convoluted way, in the way we think of the past and try to put it to the present. And I might also say that the Freedom Fighters are not the Abraham Lincoln Brigade either. When they came home, they didn't have jobs. These Freedom Fighters are each going to have $1 to $2 million profit, make movies, write books. The others were blacklisted and couldn't make a bit of money. And that's what Mr. Pfaff wrote. Now, getting back to the Gulf, the paper this past week, it was July the 19th, yesterday. Monterey Herald, U.S. told to prepare to take hit in the Gulf. The United States has to be ready to take a hit from an Iranian speedboat, starling as this may be. The Navy will help these reflagged Kuwaiti tankers in the Persian Gulf going in and out of the area, but we have to understand the Iranians' capability is largely to harass and embarrass, not to halt the flow of oil, and there is a danger that they will hit our ships, and then we will have the excuse to hit back. The Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, Hashemi Rafsanjani, has promised to attempt to further embarrass President Reagan, almost reeling from the Iran-Contra disclosures. When the U.S. warships enter the Gulf, said Rafsanjani, we will point part of our military artillery at the Yankees and take American captives with their hands on their heads with humiliation. We're ready to take them on. These people lived under the Savak, under the torture, under being called all kinds of names as if they were the scum of the world. And they say, well, you come on and we'll take you on. And this course may lead then to the United States to start attacking Iran, at which point we'll say, whether it's true or not, that the Russians are moving down to help the Iranians, and then we would have the Jerry Falwell script for the Armageddon. We'd have the Commander-in-Chief script for Ronald Reagan that he has longed for, the Roosevelt Commander-in-Chief. We'd have an end of the hearings of the House and Senate, the end of investigations of Mr. Deaver, Meese, and Nofziger, and the rest that would follow. So this is a very dangerous position we're in, and it was planned very carefully. Imagine if Jack Anderson has one plan, how many more were made. I'm going to do more on the Persian Gulf in 1 minute, take a 1 minute break, and then continue on the Persian Gulf, because in addition to what is said by Admiral Poindexter this past week, or members of Congress who were so eloquent, the first priority right now is that scene over there, as Reagan is anxious for a confrontation and nobody is tying him down, tying his hands, or taping his mouth to prevent this horrible thing from getting any worse. We'll be back in 1 minute to continue with some of the Persian Gulf.